Okay, so John's Gospel in chapter 13. I suppose when Gerard called me up on Friday and asked me to preach today, I didn't really know what to speak on. And in some senses, I was constrained by what I had preached at APC before. But the message that I'd like to preach to us tonight is, I think, very applicable to house party. Tonight, after dinner, we'll be considering, won't we, what it means to love like the Master. Well, this evening, I want to actually look at one of the clearest examples of Christ's love and of Christ's servanthood that we find in all of the Bible. So please have open John's Gospel chapter 13 in front of you. And I'd just like us to look at this passage tonight in two parts. Firstly, just look at the narrative, what takes place, what happens. And then secondly, I'd like to look at what Jesus teaches his disciples and what Jesus is teaching us. So firstly, then, what's going on? Well, we join Jesus and his disciples on the Thursday night, the Thursday evening, which is the night that Jesus will be arrested. And the next day, the Friday, he'll be crucified. This is what's commonly known as the Last Supper. This is the night before he will die. And Jesus, of course, is well aware of this fact. We read chapter 13, verse 1. Now, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father. We read throughout the Gospels, don't we? Jesus continually says, my hour has not yet come. My hour has not yet come. And yet here we read, when Jesus knew that his hour had come. So Jesus is close to the cross. He's coming close to the end of his life. And we read on in verse 2, we read, and supper being ended. That's actually not a great translation. The better translation would be, while supper was going on. This isn't the end of the supper. We're in the midst of the Last Supper. And I suppose we have to maybe address just a little question here. What would it have looked like? What sort of situation are we in here? Well, if you imagine Leonardo da Vinci's painting of the Last Supper, you know, that big long table, and all the disciples are sitting along it. Well, get that out of your mind. That's completely wrong. It would have looked nothing like that. At the Last Supper, they would have been reclining. They would have been leaning on couches, and there would have been the supper feast in the middle of the couches, and the couches would have been shaped in kind of a U kind of shape. Jesus in the centre and the disciples round about. That's why we often read, and we read in verse 23 of chapter 13, now there was leaning on Jesus' bosom, one of his disciples whom Jesus loved. Whenever I read that before, I always thought that always seemed a little bit weird. Never wrong, of course, but, you know, to lean on another man's chest. But actually, simply what it means is that John was reclining, Jesus was next to him, and therefore John's head would have been next to Jesus's chest as they were reclining. Now, usually, at any supper, there would have been a servant on hand to wash the feet of the guests who were present. This was considered such a low task that no Jewish servant was required to do it. This was a task which was left to the Gentile slave who was in the house. And of course, here we are. We're at the Last Supper and there's no servant to wash the feet of the guests present. There's no servant to wash the feet of the Lord. And therefore one might have hoped that one of the disciples would have taken it on himself to do the task, to perform that lowest task that only a Gentile slave would perform. And yet, the disciples, they have one great collective flaw, don't they? And that flaw is pride. Luke tells us in his gospel that on this very evening, there was also a dispute amongst them as to which of them should be considered the greatest. So can you imagine this group of 12 men each arguing as to who was the greatest among them? Can you imagine any one of them getting down on his knees and performing the task that only a Gentile servant would perform? There's no one to perform this task, and therefore they cannot enjoy the feast together. And therefore we read, verse 3, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God, rose from supper and laid aside his garments, took a towel, and girded himself. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. Firstly, do we see what John is saying here? Before informing us of what Christ does, he informs us of Christ's knowledge of who he is. We read, don't we, verse 3, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands and that he had come from God and was going to God. Jesus performed this act of servanthood. He performed this action that only a Gentile slave would perform in the full knowledge of who he was. He's well aware not only of what he's doing, but he's well aware of his status. He is the King of Kings. He is the Lord of Glory. He is the Son of God. And yet he kneels down and he begins to perform the task of a Gentile slave. And do you see how startled John is by this action? As we read verses 4 to 5, we see 7 distinct things that John describes. J.C. Ryle says this. He says, the minuteness with which every action of our Lord is related here is very striking. No less than 7 distinct things are named: rising, laying aside garments, taking a towel, girding himself, pouring water into a basin, washing and wiping. This is the natural language of an astonished and admiring eyewitness. In a sense, you could say this is literary slow motion. With every action that Christ performs, as he leaves his seat, as he gets the basin, as he takes his garments off, John is growing more and more astonished. You can almost imagine the disciples looking around, can't you? And they're thinking, is he really doing this? Is the Messiah, is the Son of God really going to wash our feet? And he does. One of the commentators says, the Father had put all things into his Son's hand, yet Jesus picked up a towel and a basin. We're seeing here, aren't we, a depth of humility that we can't fully comprehend. You know, at my old church in Camberwell, before I was born, every year they have what's called a church social, and people perform different acts. It's awful. But it's an endurance test, really. But they have a church social, and at the church social there's games that they put on. Well, many years ago, the pastor there, his late wife, Kate, was given a challenge. They blindfolded her and they got about 10 of the men of the church to sit on chairs and all to take their shoes and their socks off. And Kate, what she had to do was she had to go along blindfolded and feel the feet of the men. And she had to guess whose feet were Fred's. She guessed because he had hairy feet. Well, Freddie was like a gorilla. Now, it's interesting. When I told you that little story, I saw a few people on the back row and I go, ooh, like that. Well, that's right. That's horrible, isn't it? And yet, there were the feet of 21st century men. Here, Christ is kneeling down and washing the dirt from between the toes of fishermen. These were men who were working men. These men didn't moisturize. Their feet weren't pretty. They wouldn't have been put on an advertising board to advertise foot moisturizer or something like that. These feet were working men's feet. They had walked hundreds and thousands of miles. And yet Jesus, the King of Kings, takes them in his arms, in his hands even, and he washes them clean. As I say, this is a depth of humility we can't comprehend. Imagine for a moment you go back to your room tonight and you go into the ensuite and there's a lady in there and you're a bit taken aback and you look at her and suddenly you realise this is no ordinary lady. This is Queen Elizabeth II. And yet she's on the floor of the toilet and she hasn't got a crown on her head. She's got one of those bandanas that women wear. She's not got a scepter in her hand. No, she's got a scrubbing brush. She's scrubbing the floor of the toilet clean. Can you imagine that? I can't. And yet the condescension, the lowering of status for Queen Elizabeth to clean a toilet floor is nothing. Absolutely nothing compared to the Son of God, the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, performing the role of a Gentile servant. And of course, in his action, Christ is demonstrating the whole of his mission on earth, isn't he? When we look at it, we think of who Christ was. He was the host. As the host, he took the highest, the best seat at the feast. And yet he leaves that best and highest seat and he takes on himself the lowest role that it is possible to take. And of course, that's his whole mission encapsulated, isn't it? That there is the Son of God, the King of Kings, and he becomes a servant. He takes on human flesh and he performs the task of a servant. As he said in Mark's Gospel in chapter 10, he said, "The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. And to give his life a ransom for many." Christ is teaching his disciples here a lesson, not only as to how they should live, but about his whole mission. This is what he has come here for. He has come to be a servant. But of course, all this is just too much for one of the disciples. And therefore we read verse 6. "Then he came to Simon Peter, and Peter said to him, 'Lord, are you washing my feet?' Jesus answered and said to him, 'What I am doing, you do not understand now, but you will know after this.' Peter said to him, 'You shall never wash my feet.' Jesus answered him, 'If I do not wash you, you have no part with me.' Simon Peter said to him, 'Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head.'" It's typical Peter, isn't it, really? Such a contradiction. "You'll never wash my feet." And then he's saying, "Lord, wash me all over." Typical Peter. But why? Why is Peter so startled and so taken aback at the beginning? Well, of course, it's because he cannot possibly imagine that his Lord could take on such a low role. And he says, "Lord, are you washing my feet?" We're seeing here Peter being humble, aren't we? Peter is acting in humility. He's saying, "Lord, surely you can't wash my feet. I'm so much lower than you are. How can you possibly wash my feet?" And yet, when Jesus gives him an answer in verse 7, he says, "What I am doing you do not understand now, but you will know after this." Then we hear Peter saying, "You shall never wash my feet." When Peter said, "Lord, are you washing my feet?" he was asking in humility, wasn't he? And yet when he says, "You shall never wash my feet," no longer is Peter acting in humility. Peter is acting in pride. If this is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, well, when he tells me there is good reason to wash my feet, surely I am to simply submit. And yet Peter doesn't, does he? He speaks firstly in humility and then speaks in pride. And you know, I think actually there's a little lesson to learn here. And a few months ago, I spoke on a Wednesday night about a time of doubting that I had gone through. And I meet many believers and they doubt. They doubt that they're saved. And many of us struggle with assurance, don't we? And like Peter, we say, how could God love a sinner like me? How could God love someone so awful, so wretched? And we say that in humility, don't we? We see ourselves as we really are. And we ask the question, how could God possibly love me? And yet, it's so easy, isn't it, for that humility to slip into pride. And what do I mean by that? Well, I've met so many people and they've said, God could not possibly love me. I'm a sinner. I'm too bad. And people go through their whole lives doubting that God is really speaking about them when he says that he came to save the chief of sinners. And yet, friends, we must not be like Peter then, must we? We need to submit to the authority of God in every aspect of our lives. But especially when we're thinking about doubting, when we're thinking about lacking assurance. In humility, I may say, how could God ever love a sinner like me? Well, surely. Surely it's only pride which says God could never love a sinner like me. But what's Jesus' response? Jesus says to him, verse 9, if I do not wash you, you have no part with me. Simon Peter said to him, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head. Jesus said to him, he who is bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not all of you. Well, Christ is now speaking spiritually, isn't he? He's no longer talking about the dirt between Peter's toes. He's talking about the state of Peter's heart. Jesus says you need to be clean. You need to be washed clean. You know, when I was a little boy, I used to play football. I still play football. But when I was a little boy, I used to go over to the park near where I lived during the summer and during the winter, and we'd play football. And we'd get very muddy, and it was a great old time. But we lived in a terrace house, and because of that, there was no back entrance. So you could only get into the house through the front door. So I'd turn up back at home, I'd ring the doorbell, and my mum would open the door, and there I was covered in mud. And she would take one look at me, and her words were simple. She would say, you're not coming in like that. And I'd have to take my muddy socks off, I'd have to take my muddy t-shirt off. I'd pretty much have to strip down before I could enter into the house. And of course, this is the same point that Jesus is making. He's saying, you can't be in my kingdom if you haven't been washed clean. Jesus is saying, you need to be washed. You need to be made clean. But Peter, of course, he hasn't realized that Jesus is speaking spiritually. And therefore he says, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head. He's saying, wash me all over, Lord. Don't just stop at my feet. If I need to be clean to be in your kingdom, then wash me all over. Well, Jesus allays his fears, doesn't he? He says, don't worry, you've been washed. You've been washed. But you do need your feet clean. Now, what was Jesus speaking about? Well, again, sorry to keep on harping back to my childhood, but it had a big effect on me. I used to obviously live in Camberwell, as you know, and every Thursday at my primary school, we used to go swimming, and we used to go to Camberwell swimming baths. Now, Camberwell isn't the prettiest of places, but Camberwell swimming baths is quite frankly a dump. It was just an awful place. We used to get changed in the changing rooms, and there would be cockroaches running around. And I used the loos once, but I thought never again. It was an awful experience. Well, you know, when we'd come out of the swimming pool, we'd get dressed, and obviously, when you get dressed after swimming, the last thing you put on is your socks and your shoes. Well, after about 5 minutes getting changed in the changing rooms of Camberwell swimming baths, I would look at my feet and they would be covered in dirt. Obviously, when I'd come in, I'd taken a shower. But simply walking around this filthy place, my feet were now filthy. And therefore, before I could put on my shoes and my socks, I had to wash my feet under the showers again. And this is the same point that Jesus is making. And this is the same case in first century Palestine. If I was invited to a feast, I would have a wash. But then I'd have to walk to the feast. And as I walked to that feast, my feet would become dirty and dusty and sandy. And that's why when you arrived at the place where the feast was held, someone would be on hand to wash your feet. You had been washed, you were washed all over, but you needed your feet washed. What's Jesus speaking about then? If Jesus here is speaking spiritually, what is he saying? Well, he's simply saying this, Christian friends, that we need on a daily basis to come to God in repentance for our sins. Again, I'll quote J.C. Ryle. It's a bit of a long quote, but it's well worth it. He says this: once joined to Christ and cleansed in his blood, they are completely absolved and free from any spot of guilt and are counted without blame before God. But for all this, they need every day as they walk through this world to confess their daily failures and to ask for daily pardon. They require, in short, a daily washing of their feet over and above the great washing of justification, which is theirs the moment they first believe. He that neglects this daily washing is a very questionable and doubtful kind of Christian. The Christian conscience has been made more tender, hasn't it? The Christian sees their sin all the more. And the closer the Christian comes to the Lord, the more they see their sin. And therefore, Christian friends, on a daily basis, we need to come to Jesus Christ and to have our feet washed. We need to bring our sins before him again and ask for forgiveness. So a simple question. Have you washed your feet today? Did you wash your feet yesterday? Well, Jesus, having said this, finishes his task. He washes the disciples' feet and he returns to his seat. And so our second portion of this message is simply this. We just want to look at Christ's teaching. What's Christ teaching his disciples? What's Christ teaching you and me? Well, verses 12 to 17, we read, "Do you know what I have done for you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who is sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them." So three simple things to learn here. And firstly this: what Jesus was prepared to do, we ought to do as well. Jesus said, didn't he, verse 14, "If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet." Remember, these men, they have one big collective flaw, and that is pride. And therefore, Jesus gives them an example of humble service, which they are to copy. Now, does this mean literal washing of feet? Does this mean that after the service, we should all take our shoes and socks off, go outside and have a big foot washing? That's actually what the Pope does. I found this out whilst preparing this message. Apparently, in April, on what's called Holy Thursday, the Pope washes the feet of 12 men. Now, call me a cynic, but I reckon they've probably been pre-washed. But you see, he washes the feet of 12 men. Is that what we're supposed to take here? Just simply that we should wash one another's feet? Well, no, of course not. In some cases, we may need to wash each other's feet if someone's got an illness or something and they can't do it. But Christ is teaching a lesson which is so much bigger than this. In Matthew's Gospel, Jesus says this. He said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you. But whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." And that's true Christ-likeness, isn't it? True Christ-likeness, true spiritual maturity, is being willing to be a slave to others, however much it costs me. And of course, the cross is the greatest demonstration of that you could ever imagine. Christ was willing to lay down his life so that we might live. He was willing to serve rather than to be served, to give his life as a ransom for many. And this is the lesson that Jesus is teaching us here. And verse 34 and 35 of this chapter, we read, he says to his disciples, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you." If I am willing to wash your feet, if I am willing to serve you, then you also ought to be willing to serve one another. If Christ was willing to die, then we must be willing to die to self. So my desires, my ambitions, that old man that cries out, me, 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 must be prepared to die and to serve others. So, Christian, do you love your brothers and sisters in the Lord? And is that love shown in action? Love costs, doesn't it? If I continually tell Sarah that I love her, but I don't lift a finger to help, I never say a kind word to her, and in many ways I treat her as though she were nothing to me, well, I'm showing that I'm lying when I tell her I love her. Love costs, and love is shown in action. Christ has shown his love for us. Do we show our love to each other? Jesus says, doesn't he, in verse 35 of this chapter, "By this we'll all know that you are my disciples, if you have love one for another." So by Christians loving each other, all men will know that we are the disciples of Jesus Christ. Why? Well, simply this. Because by loving one another, by dying to self, and by giving our lives for others, we are showing something of Christ. We are showing the love of Jesus Christ in our lives and in our relationships. So this week, those staff who work in the kitchen who are unsaved, what would make more of an impact? Would it make more of an impact if two or three of us decided to go on a little sort of tract giving mission and sort of we started trying to get into little conversations with the kitchen staff? Well, hey, I'm all for it. Let's do that. But actually, no. The greatest demonstration that we are Christ's people, the greatest demonstration, Christ says, that we are God's children is that we love one another. That as they look at us through that little hatch, they see a group of people who are dying to self. A group of people who love one another more than we love ourselves. That's true Christ-likeness. And that is how we'll make an impact in this world. Secondly, if we've seen that what Jesus was willing to do, we also ought to be willing to do as well. Well, secondly, and maybe this is even harder, Jesus showed love to those who had no love for him. Verse 2 of chapter 13, what do we read? And supper being ended, the devil, having already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him. Mark's gospel informs us that approximately 5 to 6 days before this event, Judas Iscariot had gone to the high priests and he had gone to betray him. We read, then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went to the chief priests to betray him to them. And when they heard it, they were glad and promised to give him money. So he sought how he might conveniently betray him. And yet we see here that Judas is one of the 12. Jesus gets on his hands and knees and he washes the feet of Judas. Those feet, which 5 or 6 days before had led Judas to the high priest to betray him, those feet that would lead the temple guards and the soldiers to the Garden of Gethsemane to show them where Jesus was praying, those very same feet, Jesus Christ takes in his hands and he washes them clean. I wonder what Judas thought as he looked down on Christ performing this task. Jesus loved those who hated him. And I wonder, do we do the same? Christ doesn't just call us to love our friends, does he? He doesn't just call us to love our little circle of friends that we get on with. No. Jesus calls us to love even our enemies. And let's be honest, Christians are a difficult bunch at times, aren't they? Some Christians are insensitive. Some Christians are far too oversensitive. Sometimes they rub each other up the wrong way. Sometimes they find they just can't get on. Rather than seeing each other as brothers and sisters in the Lord, they sometimes see each other as enemies. Well, I wonder, is that someone in this room? You struggle to get on with that person. You struggle when you even hear their voice not to get angry and bitter because you've got to the point where you don't dislike them because of what they do. You just don't like them no matter what they do. And it seems almost that they've become your enemy. Well, I hope that's not the case. How sad it would be if that was the case at APC. But maybe it is. Well, Christian friend, if that is the case, Jesus Christ calls you to love that person. Jesus Christ calls you to die to self and to love that person, to show your love for that person, to pray for them, to serve them, to give your life for them. And lastly, as we close, if we were to draw everything that we've heard together tonight, if we were to draw it all together to learn one great lesson, what would it be? Well, I think it would be this. It's a lesson in Christian joy. I wonder, Christian friend, do you find that sometimes your Christian life is just devoid of happiness? Christian service, more often than not, seems simply to be a chore, and you do things simply out of duty with no joy within it all. Is that you? Does your Christian life just seem devoid of happiness? Well, I wonder, could it be that you haven't taken the lesson of Christ to your heart? One of the commentators, Warren Wiersbe, says this: it has been well said that humility is not thinking meanly of yourself. It is simply not thinking of yourself. That's humility. Not thinking of yourself. And what does Jesus say in verse 17? He says, if you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. Although personally, I like the way the Authorized Version translates this one bit. It says, if ye know these things, happy are ye if you do them. I travel around a lot of churches and I meet a lot of Christians. And I can say categorically that the most miserable Christians are those who are always thinking of themselves. Always thinking of how that person has offended me, of how that person hasn't been as kind to me as I've been to them, how they haven't returned the favour. And miserable Christians often have that one mantra in their life, me, me, me. So Christian friend, on house party this week and in your life generally, do you want to know how to be happy? Well, stop thinking of yourself. Start thinking of others. We show our love to God in the way that we treat God's people. Gerard said yesterday about Sundays, didn't he? He said, Sunday used to be the worst day of the week until I realised that Sundays were to be used for God. Then Sunday became the best day of the week. Well, your life isn't your own. Your life is not for your own edification. It's not that you can serve yourself. Your life is to serve God. And you serve God by serving his people. No matter how cruel, no matter how much they may hurt, you love God by loving his people. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you. Christian friends, may this be the theme of our week and the theme of our lives.